Morning, everyone. I'm Neil. Nice to meet you all. I'm a PhD student with Professor Wolfgang Tittle, and I'm coming from the University of Calgary. I'm here to talk to you guys today about a result that we just recently published in Nature. We've reversibly mapped photonic entanglement into and out of a solid-state device. Our quantum memory is an ensemble of thulium atoms, which are doped into a lithium niobate waveguide, and our quantum memory features a bandwidth of 5 gigahertz. So Ben talked a little bit about motivation for quantum memory, but kind of in general, we can view quantum memories as synchronization devices for quantum information. So if you have some network and you want to interact quantum information, you need to have a quantum memory to hang on to that information until you want it to interact with something. Quantum memories can be used as on-demand single photon sources when used in conjunction with probabilistic ones. Okay, and then outlined this too, that quantum memories are essential for constructing quantum repeaters, right? So we need to extend the current distance limitations on quantum communications, which with his nice cubo slides, is around 100 kilometers. So one kind of example of a quantum repeater is depicted in this little cartoon here. We have a probabilistic source of entanglement, and that interfaces with the quantum memory. And at the other end, a beam splitter operation is done, and this allows entanglement swapping, and you can repeat kind of this chain to the ends of your link, and you can swap entanglement to the ends. So the current state of the art in terms of quantum memories is depicted in this chart here. On the left-hand side, we have kind of a performance criteria that we wish to have for quantum memories. This is what we want. Here, the desired. This is what we've got. And these are the different approaches that have been used to achieve the state of the art. Of course, the ANU guys got the efficiency down. In our work, we satisfy the three criteria that are highlighted in red here. So the entanglement storage and the bandwidth and high fidelity, which is, of course, post-selected on detection. You know, those long nights in the lab, this is the one I dream about right here, of course. So there's been many different approaches to quantum memory, those based upon EIT, on and off Raman, JAM is in there. As Ben pointed out, there's a lot of these based upon the photon echo approach, which allows time reversal absorption in a controlled way. So JAM fits into that there. And our approach is a little bit different from what Ben talked about, and we use a protocol called the atomic frequency comb, and it can be used in rare earth dope crystals. So the rest of my talk will go as follows. I'll introduce the ASC quantum memory protocol, talk a little bit about rare earth crystals, and then I'll talk about the crystals that we use in our experiments. I'll then move on to the experimental setup for the entanglement storage. I'll present the results and then conclude. So we use this the ASC quantum memory protocol, which is based upon the photon echo process. So how does it work? First, you begin with some inhomogeneously broadened absorption profile. And then what you want to do is you want to tailor a comb into this profile by frequency selective optical pumping. So you remove atoms in these regions between the teeth, and you want to move them from some ground state into some long-lived auxiliary level. And the trick is with the comb is that you want to make sure that each neighboring tooth is delta spaced in frequency, okay? So that when a photon is absorbed into this comb, well, first of all, you get a collective superposition of excitations over all the atoms that are in the comb, and you get suitable phase factors there. And because this is, we're talking about photon echo here, on absorption, you get dephasing of the dipoles. But because the comb has teeth which are separated by delta, an automatic rephasing mechanism is fulfilled. And after a waiting time given by 1 over delta, the dipoles will rephase and a photon that you stored will be emitted. Okay, so this is what we do. This is what we do in our work. And if you want recall on demand, you can reversibly map the optical coherence here onto some spin coherence, and then you can map it back again. And provided that you have a certain phase shift, emission in the backwards direction is achieved, and this whole protocol can achieve 100% efficiency and fidelity, theoretically, with the potential for large bandwidth and high multimode capacity. And there's several experiments going on in the world right now. Geneva, Lund, Paris, and Calgary are a few places where this is being done. So a suitable material, which AFC can be used and used in conjunction with, are those of the rare earth ion doped crystals. And in case you don't know what rare earth ions are, well, they lie in the lanthanide series, so that's the one at the bottom of the periodic table that everybody forgets about. At least I did. So in terms of these crystals, you construct them one way you construct them is by in diffusing these rare earth ions into some crystal lattice, and because these atoms are very large, they will experience different local stresses and strains by the crystal. And because this happens, their resonance line is shifted. Okay, so if you've got a lot of atoms in some crystal, they'll have their resonance line shifted different ways, and this results in a large inhomogeneous broadening, and that can be hundreds of gigahertz in these samples. These materials also feature very long coherence times at cryogenic temperatures, and even longer spin coherence times at cryogenic temperatures. And transitions are also available in visible and telecom wavelengths. So the rare earth sample that we used in the lab is thulium. We use thulium atoms, which are doped into lithium niobate, and this is in a waveguide form. But to make the waveguide, we use also titanium. Okay, so this serves to allow us to construct this waveguide. So there's a few kind of highlights about this material, and I'll just go over them. Thulium features absorption at 795, so that's nice. That matches, the dye lasers are available. We measured the homogeneous line width around 200 kilohertz, and this again is at cryogenic temperatures. The thulium transition also matches the bandwidth of single photon detectors, right? So these are commercially available. Our sample features a large optical depth, so this kind of guarantees absorption of a photon that you want to store. As well as it has long-lived magnetically activated sublevels, which can have lifetimes upwards of a second. Okay, so the level structure is shown here to the right. You have the optical transition, some decay pathways. This is a fast decaying level. This is a slightly longer metastable state, and the lifetimes are given here, and I don't show you the magnetic sublevels. In terms of lithium niobate, well, this is a standard telecom material, so people know how to make waveguides in these things very, very well. So there's, this can be obtained rather easily. Lithium niobate also has a non-center symmetric property of its crystal, and if you apply an electric field to this crystal, then you get DC Stark shifts of the resonance line. Ben kind of pointed that out. So with these Stark shifts, we can do something like controlled or reversible inhomogeneous broadening, where we detune the electric field instead of the magnetic field, as a gem. And this can be combined with AFC. So you can get on-demand recall by detuning your electric field. In terms of the waveguide, this is a little picture here. The waveguide has a small mode diameter, so the light's confined to a very small space. This results in large gravity frequencies, possibly for efficient optical pumping. And because in a waveguide, you can space the electrodes very closely. So with low voltages, you can achieve large electric fields across the waveguide, and which can also be switched fast. So this is a possibility with the waveguide. And the structure allows simplified integration into fiber optic networks. This here is just a calculated mode profile and thulium concentration with depth in the waveguide. So moving on to the experiment. Okay, so the experiment consists of two main parts. There's the entanglement generation and detection. Then there's the memory side where we have preparation. And at the heart of the memory lies the waveguide. And this is a picture of it here. The waveguide sits on a titanium base. And we have single mode fibers, which are butt coupled into the end faces. This allows injection and retrieval of the light. This entire sample sits inside, actually, of this magnetic field coil during the experiments. And the entire thing sits inside of a cryostat, which sits at 3 Kelvin. So this is the rest of the quantum memory setup. So let me describe that to you. We have a continuous wave laser, which is amplitude intensity modulated using an acousto-optic modulator, and then frequency modulated using a phase modulator. So if you turn on and off the light and sweep the laser frequency, well, you burn a comb in your material. And this is a picture here of a 1 gigahertz section of our 5 gigahertz comb. Unfortunately, the tooth spacing for us is around 140 megahertz, and this amounts to only a 7 nanosecond storage time. So very, very, very low. We suffer from only 10% waveguide coupling efficiency into those end faces at the moment. And in terms of the memory itself, we only have 2% efficiency, so a far cry from what the Australian people are doing. But we found ways to increase this efficiency. This is limited by the finesse of the comb, which dictates the efficiency, and the non-uniformity. So even though we have 5 gigahertz, we realized afterwards that a lot of it was not very uniform. So we just had absorption. The timing of our experiment is given here. We write the comb for 10 milliseconds. And after that, we wait 2 milliseconds for excited level population to decay. Because if we have decay happening when we try to recall photons, then we're going to add noise to our signal. So the storage and retrieval of the entangled photons are done over 40 milliseconds. And this is done by interfacing an entangled photon with the memory via a switch. So on the entanglement side of things, we generate entanglement. We have a pump laser, produces a short pulse, which is frequency doubled. And then we send this pulse into an unbalanced Mach-Zehnder interferometer. And this results in a state which has an early and a late time bend. Okay? And this particular state then undergoes spontaneous parametric down conversion. And to approximation, we generate individual entangled photon pairs here in the 5 plus state. And this is in the early late basis. One arm is at 795, the other arm is at 1532. And these coincide with the free space and telecom transmission windows. Of course, 1532 can be sent down fibers, and 795 is on resonance with thulium, right? The photons from each arm are then filtered, and the 795 side, we either send the entangled photon into the memory, or we bypass it for analysis. So the analysis is done using these qubit analyzers, which feature a delay line, and this allows us to measure along the poles of the Bloch sphere, or in the basis of early and late. They also feature another unbalanced Mach-Zehnder interferometer, and this allows us to measure along the plane of the Bloch sphere. Okay, so with these measurements, we can reconstruct a 2-qubit density matrix. So here it is. Here they are, with storage and without storage. We showed them in the early-late basis, and we only show the real components as the imaginary components are less than 0.04. Now I'll ask you guys a question. Can anybody see a difference? Yeah, well, a few of you guys, yeah, practical jokers. At first glance, I can't see a difference. No, it's true. There's a slight difference, but qualitatively speaking, they're very much the same. But that's not enough, right? We need to have a quantitative comparison. So let's calculate some relevant parameters that allow us to do this. First one here, the amount of entanglement. So we look at the state without storage, and we begin with a state which has entanglement formation of only 0.64. And this is, we know this is due to the fact that we have multi-pair emissions. Okay, so a reduced amount of entanglement. But the important thing is here that is after the memory, well, this is preserved. Okay, so we have preservation of entanglement. This preservation is shown directly with the measurement of the fidelity with and without storage. So we have 95% overlap. The purity, again, is low due to multi-pair emissions, but again, it's preserved. And the fidelity to the 5 plus is preserved. In a separate experiment, we measured the maximum value of the S parameter in the CHSH Bell inequality. And clearly, without and with storage, we violate the bound of 2, which is given by local hidden variable models. So in conclusion, our work is the first demonstration of a reversible mapping of an entangled photon into and out of a solid-state device. But I also want to point out the work by the group of Nicolas Jezun. They succeeded in storing at energy time entangled photon into a neodymium crystal. However, our approach is integrated and broadband, and this allows simple interfacing with sources of non-classical light. However, we suffer from limited efficiency and a preset short storage time. The next steps we like to take are teleportation and entanglement swapping into the memory. So I'd like to thank my group, Wolfgang, Erhan, Josh, Jin, and Dan, and our collaborators, Wolfgang, Matthew, Ryman, Felix, and our sponsors here. And finally, I leave you with a movie poster, which was constructed by one of our undergrads in our group to commemorate this work. Not a night at the museum, but a night in the memory lab, a battle for photon storage. Thank you.